GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODNAME139 for $7.49.com domain names. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1136, August 13, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you from home. I spent the night last night there along Interstate 44 at that truck stop, wherever it was. And then, so I got up this morning, I set my alarm clock for 8 a.m. My alarm clock, of course, is an old cell phone that's kind of been out of commission for probably a good 3.5 years. But it still works quite well as an alarm clock. So anyway, I set that and it woke me. It went right off at 8 a.m. And so I got up and got underway pretty quickly, and so I made it down to Fort Smith. I guess it was about 1:15, 1:30 this afternoon. They had me back into the dock at that place right away, but they didn't. The unloading appointment was at 3 o'clock, and so they actually didn't start unloading the load until it was probably 10 or 15 minutes after 3, they started unloading the load. And then, of course, once they started, it went very quickly. And so I was leaving there, I think it was about 4:15 when I pulled out of their gate and headed on home. And so I got home, I guess it was sometime probably pushing 5:30 when I actually, after I dropped the trailer down at the wrecker service and then pulled into my driveway. So I got home around 5:30, something like that. So that worked out fairly well. And now, of course, my parents are, you know, they were going to leave originally. They were going to leave this morning, but then they, instead of Wednesday, they decided they'd go ahead and leave on Thursday. And, you know, so they'd get to see me, briefly this evening. And so they're going to leave in the morning, and I think they're heading for Kansas in their motorhome. I think they're going to stop in, where did they say? Coffeyville, Kansas, and then eventually they'll end up over by Wichita. His older sister. He's got several sisters. One of them already died. The oldest one already died a few months ago, and the one now is she's kind of gotten bad. Gotten in bad shape all of a sudden, really, in just recent months. She has really kind of gone downhill, and so now she's in they just moved her into a rest home, because she, up until this point, she's been living in a house by herself, you know, with people, you know, with her kids checking on her periodically. But she's kind of got to the point where she can't really take care of herself, and so they've moved her into a rest home. And I think, you know, from what they're saying, she's not in very good condition and probably isn't going to last very long. And so they're going to go up and see her and kind of hang out there for a while. And then after that, I think they're going to be gone. You know, they're planning on coming back here probably in, you know, 3 weeks to a month. So, you know, so they're heading out tomorrow. So I'm going to be, you know, the whole time I'm going to be home, I'm going to be, you know, they're not going to be around. And so I'm going to have probably plenty of time to do the normal stuff that I do when I'm home when they're not here. Of course, if they're here, they act like a magnet. You know, if my parents are here with her, you know, if they're here, you know, like during the summer or at Christmas or Thanksgiving, they act like a magnet. And of course, you know, end up with all kinds of relatives around, and you know, which is great. You know, both of my younger brothers end up coming out here. One of them ended up coming out here last, or tonight actually, and kind of, you know, spent some time with us. And you know, so it's great when they're here, because they do, you know, my mom's always, you know, cooking all these family dinners and what have you. And it really does, you know, it's great when they're here. But that, with all the relatives around, it kind of makes it difficult at times for me to get very much done. Some of the things that I'd really like to do kind of get put on the back burner, you know, if everything's kind of taken up with the relatives. So this time, you know, that I'm home, apart from this evening, you know, I'm going to be just here by myself. And so I'll, you know, I've got some things, nothing really planned necessarily, but you know, I've just kind of got things to do, and probably just going to sit, you know, spend part of the time just kind of sitting around, not doing much of anything. you know, just being away from the truck, which is always, it's always good to get away from the truck. You know, about every three and a half weeks, I like to just, you know, kind of park the truck and kind of forget about it for a few days. And then typically after about 4 or 5 days, I'm ready to go back to work and, you know, and actually kind of look forward to it after a point. So anyway, what I want to do, we're up to chapter 8 on this Russian textbook. It's a Russian textbook about, you know, and this was published probably in the 1930s, and it may have been published before that, but it's a Russian textbook on how to basically infiltrate a country, and it's referencing the United States. They want to convert, their goal was to convert the United States to communism. And so this Russian textbook was sort of presented to people, operatives, American operatives, that they brought to Russia, and they were essentially schooling them, and their own operatives, of course, but they were essentially schooling them on how to essentially take over the country, cause it to become communist. And it's really interesting reading. And I think we're at the point now, we've heard this all our lives. I know I've heard this, there's been this kind of sort of a low background noise for years about how the country's going to hell in a handbasket. And we've all heard how the communists were kind of trying to infiltrate and take the country over and what have you. And I think in the past, you know, I've presented this information to people and they kind of didn't want to hear it. They really didn't want to hear it. But I think at this point, with what's happening with our Congress and the president really trying to cram things, that are just horrible legislation, down our throats and not listen to the people, I think at this point, people are to the point now where they're kind of pulling their head out of the sand, because at first, just a few months ago, after the election, after Obama was elected and both houses of Congress were basically Democrat, controlled by Democrats, there were a fair number of people that were trying to stick their head in the sand and pretend like, well, things, you know, they can't be that bad. The economy's going to get better. They were kind of pretending like, you know, wanting to pretend like, well, this isn't happening. But it is happening, and a lot of people, I think, at this point now are—they're deciding, "Hey, I'm not going to put up with this. This is my country. This is, you know, it's a representative democracy. It's a republic. These lawmakers work for us, the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And we're not going to put up with this." And so, I think at this point, this information in this, you know, in this Russian textbook is really good information, and I think a lot of people now are probably open to it. And as I say, this stuff is really remarkable. The information that they have in here, a lot of it is extremely valid, but they only had half of the equation, because these people did not believe in God. Whoever wrote this book, and of course the communist state, they did not believe in God. They believed that the state was God. They believed essentially that they could create their own God, that there was no natural God that created the world, the universe, human beings. They believed that somehow it was just all kind of random chance, but they could make their own God with the state, create their own God out of the state. And that was the fatal problem. That's why the Soviet Union ended up collapsing, was essentially because they did not believe in God. They didn't have the entire equation. Now, a lot of this, a lot of what I've already read, and by the way, if you're listening to this for the first time, you can go back to the prior three podcasts as when I started reading through this, and you can kind of catch up on it, and I would strongly suggest that you do, because it's very good information. But a lot of this information focuses on how to brainwash people, how to essentially make them do things that they didn't want to do. And the reason, you know, they're talking about torturing, and, you know, there are a fair number of people that all you got to do is just, you know, people are incredibly suggestible, and all you have to do is just start making suggestions to them and they'll respond. And then there are other people that are more resistant to that, and so they're talking about how you essentially half-starve people, make their, you know, deprive them of sleep over a period of time. Then you know use things like electric shock and, you know, different forms of torture in order to implant suggestions into them, and then kind of cause them to reliably execute the instruction set on cue, and all it would take was they could make the trigger to make someone execute the instruction set. It could be, you know, the trigger could be anything. It could be a sound. It could be an object. It could be an image of some sort. It could be a word or series of words. And, you know, people don't believe that, but it's absolutely true. Now, the thing you have to keep in mind is that in order for this sort of post-hypnotic suggestion stuff to work, it absolutely requires resentment. And, you know, if you imagine that these people are being starved and they're being deprived of sleep and they're in this horrible condition, probably in their own filth, and then they're being shocked and God knows what else. You can almost guarantee that they resent. And resentment is the key. Because if they're resenting whoever's shocking them and starving them and beating them and whatever they're doing to them, if they're resenting, then they're playing God in their own minds. The person that's being, you know, the person that's being the victim, you know, that's being beaten and starved and whatever else. If they're resenting, then they become suggestible, and they become extremely suggestible. And as this document suggests, people will do things, they can be made to do things against their own best wishes. Absolutely they can. But the key is resentment. And, you know, and but what this text suggests is that if all it takes is, you know, they have the trigger, whatever the trigger is, as I say, the trigger could be a series of words or it could be whatever else, you know, whatever the trigger, whatever they decide that they want the trigger to be. Let's say a series of words, for example, a phrase. And then if they don't, you know, then that should execute the program behavior. And if it doesn't, then the person begins to feel the agony all over again, therefore forcing them to execute the commands, whatever the command set was. But again, it requires resentment. You know, and so I was thinking about this. You know, because, you know, I've got all these tattoos. You know, I'm covered with them. And some of them, you know, some of them, some of them hurt worse than others. Some of them really, you know, some of them really hurt like hell. And so here I am subjecting myself to that. But, you know, it would be stupid, silly, if I resented the tattoo artist or I resented the experience. So, you know, here I am, you know, kind of voluntarily submitting myself to some fairly intense pain, and that could be construed as torture, depending on the circumstance. But, you know, since I'm voluntarily submitting myself to it and I want it, you know, I have to go through it if I want the tattoo, then, you know, it's not. And I don't resent the experience. And so, therefore, you had the same pain, probably, you know, the same levels of pain that if someone resented, then they would end up being suggestible. You know, and so it's resentment that really creates the suggestibility. And of course, the you know, this text really doesn't go into that. You know, it doesn't go into judgment, it doesn't go into resentment on the you know, because they don't believe in God. They don't believe that you know, judgment and resentment, you know, they don't really believe that that's possible, you know, in the sense that I talk about all the time. You know, someone playing God in their own minds, you know, essentially judging. So, anyway, let me go ahead and just jump right on into this. So we're going to start out, we've been through chapters 1 through 7. So now we're ready for chapter 8. So here we go. Chapter 8, Degradation, Shock, and Endurance. Degradation and conquest are companions. in order to be conquered, a nation must be degraded, either by acts of war, by being overrun, by being forced into humiliating treaties of peace, or by the treatment of her populace under the armies of the conqueror. However, degradation can be accomplished much more insidiously and much more effectively by consistent and continual defamation. Defamation is the best and foremost weapon of psychopolitics on the broad field. Continual and constant degradation of national leaders, national institutions, national practices, and national heroes must be systematically carried out. But this is the chief functions of Communist Party members in general, not the psychopolitician. The psychopolitician's realm of defamation and degradation is man himself. By attacking the character and morals of man himself and by bringing about, through contamination of youth, a general degraded feeling, command of the populace is facilitated to a marked degree. There is a curve of degradation that leads downward to a point where the endurance of an individual is almost at an end, and any sudden action toward him will place him in a state of shock. Similarly, a soldier held prisoner can be abused, denied, defamed, and degraded until the slightest motion on the part of his captors will cause him to flinch. Similarly, the slightest word on the part of his captors will cause him to obey or vary his loyalties and beliefs. Given sufficient degradation, a prisoner can be caused to murder his fellow countrymen in the same stockade. Experiments on German prisoners have lately demonstrated that after 70 days of filthy food, little sleep, and nearly untenable quarters, the least motion toward the prisoner will bring about a state of shock beyond his endurance threshold and will cause him to receive hypnotically anything said to him. Thus, it is possible in an entire stockade of prisoners numbering into the thousands to bring about a state of complete servile obedience and without having to personally address each one, pervert their loyalties and implant in them adequate commands to ensure their future conduct even after their release to their own people. By lowering the endurance of a person, a group, or a nation, and by constant degradation and defamation, a state of shock can be induced that will cause an adequate response to any command. The first thing to be degraded in any nation is the state of man himself. Nations that have high ethical tone are difficult to conquer. Their loyalties are hard to shake, their allegiance to their leaders is fanatical, and what they usually call their spiritual integrity cannot be violated by duress. It is not efficient to attack a nation in such a frame of mind. It is the basic purpose of psychopolitics to reduce that state of mind to a point where it can be ordered and enslaved. Thus, the first target is man himself. He must be degraded from a spiritual being to an animalistic reaction pattern. He must think of himself as an animal capable only of animalistic reactions. He must no longer think of himself or his fellows as capable of spiritual endurance or nobility. The best approach toward degradation is its first stages is the propaganda of scientific approach to man. Man must be consistently demonstrated to be a mechanism without individuality, and the idea must be programmed into a populace under attack that man's individualistic reactions are the products of mental derangement. The populace must be made to believe that every individual within it who rebels in any way, shape, or form against efforts and activities to enslave the whole must be considered to be a deranged person whose eccentricities are neurotic or insane, and who must be referred at once to the treatment of a psychopolitician licensed as a mental healer. An optimum maneuver in such a program of degradation is to address itself to the military forces of the nation and disabuse them rapidly from any belief other than the disobedient one must be subjected to mental treatment. The enslavement of a population can fail only if these rebellious individuals are left to exert their individual influence upon their fellow citizens, sparking them into rebellion, calling into account their past nobility and ideals of freedom. Unless these restless individuals are stamped out and given into the hands of psychopolitical operatives early in the game, there will be nothing but trouble as the conquest continues. The officials of the government, students, readers, partakers, and providers of entertainment must all be indoctrinated by whatever means into the complete belief that the restless, the ambitious, the natural leaders are suffering from environmental maladjustments which can be healed only by recourse to psychopolitical operatives in the guise of mental healers. By thus degrading the general belief in the status of man, it is relatively simple, with cooperation from the economic salience being driven into the country, to drive citizens apart one from another, to bring into question the wisdom of their own government, and to cause them to beg actively for a takeover. The educational programs of psychopolitics must at every hand seek out the levels of youth who will become the leaders in the country's future and educate them into a belief in the animalistic nature of man. This must be made fashionable. They must be taught to frown upon ideas, upon individual endeavor. They must be taught, above all things, that the salvation of man is to be found only through his perfect adjustment to this environment. This educational program in the field of psychopolitics can best be followed by bringing about a compulsory training in some subjects such as psychology or other mental practice, and seeing to it that each broad program of psychopolitical training is supervised by a psychiatrist who is a trained psychopolitical operative. As it seems that the church is the most ennobling influence in foreign nations, each and every branch of activity of each and every church must one way or another be discredited. Religion must be made unfashionable by our demonstrating broadly through psychopolitical indoctrination that the soul is non-existent and that man is an animal. The lying mechanisms of Christianity lead man to foolishly brave deeds by teaching them that there is a life hereafter. The church minimizes the liability of courageous acts during this lifetime, and the liability of any act must be markedly increased if a populace is to be obedient. Thus, there must be no standing belief in the church, and the power of the church must be denied at every opportunity. The psychopolitical operative in his program of degradation should at all times bring into question any family that is deeply religious, and should any neurosis or insanity be occasioned in that family, he should blame and hold responsible their religious connections for the neurotic or psychotic condition. Religion must be made synonymous with neurosis and psychosis. People who are deeply religious would be less than held likely to be responsible for their own sanity, and should more and more be relegated to the ministrations of psychopolitical operatives. By perverting the institutions of a nation and bringing about a general degradation by interfering with the economics of a nation to the degree that privation and depression become commonplace, only minor shocks will be necessary to produce, on the populace as a whole an obedient reaction or an hysteria. Thus, the mere threat of war, the mere threat of bombings, could cause the population to sue instantly for peace. It is long and arduous road for the psychopolitical operative to achieve this state of mind on the part of a whole nation, but no more than 20 or 30 years should be necessary to run the entire program. Having to hand, as we do, weapons with which to accomplish the goal. Chapter 9. The Organization of Mental Health Campaigns. Psychopolitical operatives should at all times be alert to the opportunity to organize mental health clubs or groups for the betterment of the community. By thus inviting the cooperation of the population as a whole in the mental health programs, properly guided, can bring enough legislative pressure on the government to secure the position of the psychopolitical operative and to obtain for him government grants and facilities, thus bringing a government to finance its own downfall. Mental health organizations must carefully delete from their ranks anyone actually proficient in the handling or treatment of mental health. The priests, ministers, actually trained psychoanalysts, good hypnotists, or trained Dianeticists must be excluded. These, with some cognizance of the subject of mental aberration and its treatment, and with some experience in observing the mentally deranged, if allowed in large numbers within institutions, and if permitted to receive literature, would sooner or later become suspicious of the activities carried on by the psychopolitical operative. These must be defamed and excluded as untrained, unskillful, quacks, or perpetrators of hoaxes. No mental health movement with actual goals of mental therapy should be allowed to continue in existence in any nation. For instance, the use of Chinese acupuncture in the treatment of mental and physical derangement must, in China, be stamped out and discredited thoroughly, as it has some efficacy, and more importantly, its practitioners understand, through long acquaintance with it, many of the principles of actual mental health and aberration. In the field of mental health, the psychopolitician must occupy and continue to occupy, through various means, the authoritative position on the subject. There is always the danger that problems of mental health may be resolved by some individual or group, which might then discredit the program of the psychopolitical operative in his mental health clubs. City officials, socialites, and other outstanding individuals, uninformed on the subject of mental health, should be invited to full participation in the activity of mental health groups. But the sole aim of this activity should be to finance better facilities for the psychopolitical practitioner. To these groups, it must be continually stressed, the entire subject of mental illness is so complex that none of them certainly could understand any part of it. Thus, the club should be kept on a social and financial level. Where groups interested in the health of the community have already been formed, they should be infiltrated and taken over, and if this is not possible, they should be discredited, and the officialdom of the area should be invited to stamp them out as dangerous. When a hostile group dedicated to the mental health is discovered, the psychopolitician should have recourse to peyote, mescaline, and other drugs that cause temporary insanity. He should send persons, preferably those well under his control, into the mental health group, whether founded on Christian Science, Dianetics, or faith preaching, to demonstrate their abilities upon this new person. These, in demonstrating their abilities, will usually act with enthusiasm midway in the course of their treatment. A quiet injection of peyote, mescaline, or other drug, or an electric shock administered by a psychopolitician will produce the symptoms of insanity in the patient that has been sent to the target group. The patient, thus demonstrating momentary insanity, should immediately be reported to the police and taken away to some area of incarceration managed by psychopolitical operatives and so placed out of sight. Officialdom will thus come to believe that this group drives individuals insane by their practices, and the practices of the group will then be despised and prohibited by law. The values of widespread mental health organization are manifest when one realizes that any government can be forced to provide facilities for psychopolitical operatives in the form of psychiatric wards in all hospitals and national institutions totally in the hands of psychopolitical operatives, and in the establishment of clinics where youth can be contacted and forced into better alignment with the purposes of psychopolitics. Such groups form a political force, which can then legalize any law or authority desired by the psychopolitical operative. The securing of authority over such mental health organizations is managed mainly by appeal to education. A psychopolitical operative should make sure that those psychiatrists he controls, those psychologists whom he has under his orders, have been trained for an excessively long period of time. The longer the training period that can be required, the safer the psychopolitical program, since no new group of practitioners can arise to uncover and embarrass the psychopolitical programs. Furthermore, the groups themselves cannot hope to obtain any full knowledge of the subject, not having behind them many, many years of intensive training. Vienna has been carefully maintained as the home of psychopolitics, since it was the home of psychoanalysis. Although our activities have long since dispersed any of the gains made by Freudian groups and have taken over these groups, the proximity of Vienna to Russia, where psychopolitics is operated abroad, and the necessity for further study by psychopolitical operatives in the birthplace of psychoanalysis makes periodic contacts with headquarters possible. Thus, the word psychoanalysis must be stressed at all times and must be pretended to be a thorough part of the psychiatrist's training. Psychoanalysis profits greatly from its possession of a vocabulary and a workability that is sufficiently poor to avoid recovery of psychopolitical implantations. It can be made fashionable throughout mental health organizations and by learning its patter and by believing they see some of its phenomena, and the members of the mental health groups can believe themselves conversant with mental health because its stress is sex. It is itself an adequate defamation of character and serves the purposes of degradation well. Thus, in organizing mental health groups, the literature furnished such groups should be psychoanalytical in nature. If a group of persons interested in suppressing juvenile delinquency and in caring for the insane and indirectly the promotion of psychopolitical operatives and their actions can be formed in every major city of a country under conquest, the success of a psychopolitical program is assured, since these groups seem to represent a large segment of the population. By continual exposure to the airing of propaganda on the subject of dope addiction, homosexuality, and depraved conduct on the part of the young, even the judges of a country can become suborned into reacting violently against the youth of the country, thus misarranging the youth and gaining their support for our goals at the same time. The communication lines of psychopolitics, if such mental health organizations can be well established in a country, can thus run from its most prominent citizens to its government. It is not too much to hope that the influence of such groups could bring about a psychiatric ward in every hospital in the land and psychiatrists in every company and regiment of the nation's army, and whole government institutes manned entirely by psychopolitical operatives into which ailing government officials could be placed to the advantage of the psychopolitician. If a psychiatric ward could be established in every hospital in every city in a nation, it is certain that, at one time or another, every prominent citizen of the nation could come under the ministrations of psychopolitical operatives or their dupes. The validation of a need for psychiatric evaluations in the armed forces and security-minded institutions of the nation under conquest could bring about a flow and fund of information unlike any other program imaginable. If every pilot who flies a new plane, could come under the questioning of psychopolitical operative, if the compiler of every plan of military action could thus come under the review of psychopolitical operatives, the simplicity with which information can be extracted by the use of certain drugs without the afterknowledge of the soldier would entirely cripple any overt action toward communism. If the nation could be educated into turning over to psychopolitical operatives every recalcitrant or rebellious soldier, it would lose its best fighters. Thus, the advantage of mental health organizations could be seen for these by exerting an apparent pressure against the government in the public interest, of course, can achieve these ends and goals. The financing of psychopolitical operation is difficult unless it is done by the citizens and the government. Although vast sums of money can be obtained from private patients and from relatives who wish to put persons away, it is nevertheless difficult to obtain millions unless the government itself is cooperating. The cooperation of the government needed to obtain these vast sums of money is best obtained by the organization of mental health groups composed of leading citizens who bring their lobbying abilities to bear against the nation's government. Thus, can many programs be financed that might otherwise have had to be set aside by the psychopolitician. The psychopolitical operative should exert consistent and continual effort toward forming and continuing in action innumerable mental health groups. The psychopolitical operative should also spare no expense in smashing out of existence by whatever means any actual healing group, such as that of acupuncture in China, such as Christian Science, Dianetics, and Faith Healing in the United States, such as Catholicism in Italy and Spain, and the practical psychological groups of England. Let me see how long the next chapter is. Chapter 10. Okay, it's fairly short. I'm going to go ahead and pause this for a minute. Throat's getting a little bit dry. I'm going to get a drink and take a little bit of a break. Be right back. I'm back. So we're ready for Chapter 10. Chapter 10. Conduct Under Fire. The psychopolitician may well find himself under attack as an individual or member of a group. He may be attacked as a communist through some leak in the organization, or he may be attacked for malpractice. He may be attacked by the families of the people he has injured. In all cases, his conduct in the situation should be calm and aloof. He should have behind him the authority of many years of training, and he should have participated fully in the building of defenses in the field of insanity, which gave him the sole claim to expertise on conditions of the mind. If he has not done his work well, an individual psychopolitician may be exposed by hostile groups. These may call into question the efficacy of psychiatric treatments such as shock, drugs, and general treatment. Not one of the cases cited need be real, but they should be documented and printed in such a fashion as to form excellent court evidence. When his allegiance is attacked, the psychopolitical operative should explain his connection with Vienna on the grounds that Vienna is the place of study for all important matters of the mind. More importantly, he should laugh into scorn by reason of his authority the sanity of the person attacking him. If the psychopolitical archives of the country are adequate, many defamatory data can be unearthed and presented as a rebuttal if needed. Should anyone attempt to expose psychotherapy as a psychopolitical activity, the best defense is calling into question the sanity of the attacker. The next best defense is authority. The next best defense is a validation of psychiatric practices in terms of long and impressive figures. The next best defense is the actual removal of the attacker by giving him or them treatment sufficient to bring about a period of insanity for the duration of the trial. This, more than anything else, would discredit them, but it is extremely dangerous to manage. Psychopolitics should avoid murder and violence unless it is done in the safety of the institution on persons who have been proven to be insane. Where institution deaths appear to be unnecessary or to rise in unreasonable numbers, political capital might be made of this by city officials or legislature. If the psychopolitical operative himself or if his group has done a thorough job, defamatory data concerning the person or connections of the would-be attacker should be on file, should be documented, and should be used in such a way as to discourage the inquiry. After a period of indoctrination, a country will expect insanity to be met by psychopolitical violence. Psychopolitical activities should become the only recognized treatment for insanity. Indeed, this notion can be carried to such lengths that it could be made illegal for electric shock and brain surgery to be omitted in the treatment of a patient. In order to defend psychopolitical activities, a great complexity should be made of psychiatric, psychoanalytical, and psychological technology. Any hearing should be burdened by terminology too difficult to be transcribed easily. A great deal should be made out of such terms as schizophrenia, paranoia, and other relatively undefinable states. Psychopolitical tests need not necessarily be in agreement one to another where they are available to the public. Various types of insanity should be characterized by difficult terms. The actual state should be made obscure, but this verbiage can insinuate into the court or investigating mind that a scientific approach exists and that it is too complex for him to understand. It is not to be imagined that a judge or a committee of investigation should inquire too deeply into the subject of insanity, since they themselves, part of the indoctrinated masses, are already intimidated if the psychopolitical activity has managed to become well documented in magazine horror stories. In case of a hearing or trial, the awfulness of insanity itself, its threat to society, should be exaggerated until the court or committee believes that the psychopolitical operative is vitally necessary in his post and should not be harassed by the activities of persons who are irrational. An immediate attack upon the sanity of the attacker before any possible hearing can take place is the very best defense. It should become well known that only the insane attack psychiatrists. The byword should be built into the society that paranoia is a condition in which the individual believes he is being attacked by communists. This defense will be found to be effective. Part of an effective defense should include the society's entire lack of any real psychotherapy. Any real therapy must be systematically stamped out, since real psychotherapy might possibly uncover the results of psychopolitical activities. Jurisprudence in a capitalistic nation is so clumsy that cases are invariably tried in their newspapers. We have handled these things much better in Russia and have uniformly brought people to trial with full confessions already arrived at, having been implanted before the trial takes place. Should any whisper or pamphlet against psychopolitical activities be published, it should be laughed into scorn, branded immediately as a hoax, and its perpetrator or publisher should be, at the first opportunity, branded insane, and by the use of drugs, the insanity should be confirmed. So let's see how large the next chapter is. Let's see how long it goes on. Oh, it's very short. Chapter 11, The Use of Psychopolitics in Spreading Communism. Reactionary nations are of such a composition that they attack a word without understanding it. As the conquest of a nation by communism depends on imbuing its population with communistic tenets, it is not necessary that the term communism be applied at first to the educative measures employed. As an example, in the United States, we have been able to alter the works of William James and others into a more acceptable pattern and to place the tenets of Karl Marx, Pavlov, Lamarck, and the data of dialectic materialism into the textbooks of psychology to such a degree that anyone making a thorough study of psychology becomes at once a candidate to accept the reasonableness of communism. As every chair of psychology in the United States is occupied by persons connected with us, or who can be influenced by persons connected with us, the constant employment of such texts is guaranteed. They are given authoritative ring and they are carefully taught. Constant pressure on the legislature of the United States can bring about legislation to the effect that every student attending a high school or university must have classes in psychology. Educating broadly the educated strata of the populace into the tenets of communism is thus rendered relatively easy, and when the choice is given them whether to continue in a capitalistic or a communistic condition, they will see suddenly in communism much more reasonableness than in capitalism, which will now be seen by our own definition. And let's see, chapter 12 looks pretty short, so we'll just go ahead and do it. Chapter 12, Violent Remedies. As populaces in general understand that violence is necessary in the handling of the insane, violent remedies seem to be reasonable. Starting from a relatively low level of violence, such as straitjackets and other restraints, it is relatively easy to encroach upon the public diffidence where violence is concerned by adding more and more cruelty to the treatment of the insane. By increasing the brutality of treatment, the public expectation of such treatment will be assisted, and the protest of the individual to whom the treatment is given is possible, since immediately after the treatment he is incapable. The family of the individual under treatment is already suspect for having had in its midst an insane person. The family's protest should be discredited. The more violent the treatment, the more command value the psychopolitical operative will accumulate. Brain operations should become standard and commonplace, while the figures of actual deaths should be repressed wherever possible. It is nevertheless of no great concern to the psychopolitical operative that many deaths do occur. Gradually, the public should be educated in electric shock, first by being led to believe that it is very therapeutic, then by believing that it is quieting, then by being informed that electric shock usually injures the spine and teeth, and finally, that it very often kills or at least breaks the spine and removes violently the teeth of the patient. It is very doubtful if anyone from the lay levels of the public could tolerate the observation of a single electric shock treatment. Certainly, they could not tolerate witnessing a prefrontal lobotomy or transorbital leukectomy. However, they should be brought up to a level where this is possible, where it is the expected treatment, and where the details of the treatment itself can be made known, thus adding the psychopolitical prestige. The more violent the treatment, the more hopeless insanity will seem to be. The society should be worked up to the level where every recalcitrant young man can be brought into court and assigned to a psychopolitical operative, given electric shocks, then reduced into unimaginative docility for the remainder of his days. By continuous and increasing advertising of the violence of treatment, the public will at last come to tolerate the creation of zombie conditions to such a degree that they will probably employ zombies if given to them. Thus, a large stratum of the society, particularly that which was rebellious, can be reduced to the service of the psychopolitician. By various means, a public must at least be convinced that insanity can only be met by shock, torture, deprivation, defamation, discreditation, violence, maiming, death, punishment in all its forms. The society at the same time must be educated into the belief that insanity is increasing within its ranks. This creates an emergency and places the psychopolitician in a savior role that will eventually put him in charge of the society. And yeah, we're pushing 60 minutes here, so probably better bring this to the end, or to an end right now. So next time we'll start with chapter 13. So we've gone through chapters 1 through 12 so far. So in any case, again, I think that a lot of people now in our society are ready to be able to read this and kind of be interested in it and understand it. Because we're seeing, we're seeing a lot of this in action. I mean, if you, you know, as I read through this, you know, a lot of this stuff, you know, the degradation of our society, the degradation of our country's leaders, it's been going on for years and years and years. Ridicule of churches, ridicule of religion, so on and so forth. And then, of course, you have the crazies that are there. And there are some crazy people that are present, you know, in every city, every society. And in a lot of religions, there are crazy people, you know, the kind of the fanatics. And of course, TV often paints people into corners, paints people as crazy idiots. And it causes people to sort of end up with this image in their mind that kind of guilt by association, that, you know, that people that are really believe in morals or really believe in various principles are crazy. you know? And so all of these elements are present, and there have been people for the longest time, you know, for example, the university system is just overrun with people that believe in Marxism, and you've got Marxist professors and people pushing socialism and so on and so forth. There's a lot of, for the most part, I think large urban populations have really been indoctrinated into this, thinking that socialism is just a wonderful thing. And of course, where they've met resistance is people that are living in more rural areas. More rural areas, so-called red parts of the country, red states, as opposed to blue cities, the red areas of the country, more rural areas, people are closer to their common sense, and they've been able to resist a lot of this, these pressures that have been brought to bear, and that you know, that are continually being brought to bear. And so at this point, our country is in a really dangerous position. And so, but I think that the pain has a way of waking people up. You know, if people resent pain, as kind of indicated by this text, if you resent pain, you know, whether it's emotional pain, psychological pain, physical pain, it causes you to become suggestible. But sometimes pain, if you don't resent it, if the pain comes along and you don't resent the pain, sometimes it can cause you to wake up. It can cause you to want to wake up. And that's what I kind of see happening with a lot of people. A lot of people have been kind of in pain, and you know, the pain kind of came along, and you know, they at first, some of them have had this reaction, oh well, I want to bury my head in the sand and try to grab all the gusto that I can, kind of reaction. And then, but then people, a lot of those people are suddenly kind of saying, hey, wait a minute, this is ridiculous, let's get to the bottom of this. And so it's my hope that we can turn this all around, and I think it is being turned around. We're in the process of it. But so in the meantime, you know, now it's we may turn it around temporarily, possibly, but in the, you know, the longer term is a problem, because there are a lot of kids being born out of wedlock. There are a lot of kids that have just been completely screwed up. Their parents parked them in front of the television. The parents don't know how to be good parents, and that does not portend well for the future of the country. So, but it's not an impossible situation. But on the other hand, it does require people to stop resenting and to wake up. And it basically all of this comes down to resentment. You know, and learning not to resent. You know, having the willingness to not resent. And I think that's really the key. But of course, having that willingness to not resent is a complete mystery as to why some people have it and some people don't. So, anyhow, hope everyone is having a great week, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.